I'm somebody who was symptomatic from my very first period ever at 12 years of age, and I was diagnosed in 2018. So
how would someone know if that's what they're going through?
Definitely be a sign that you should be investigated.
So because it is such a confusing condition.
That's one of the most frustrating recommendations when doctors are like, yeah, just go and get pregnant.
Welcome back to Healthy as a Mother. I'm your co-host, Dr. Leah Gordon, and this is the show for becoming and being a mother, where Dr. Morgan and I share the natural women's health and motherhood guidance you've been looking for through a fresh, functional, and balanced lens. Today, I have the privilege of interviewing Cindy all about endometriosis. If you are someone who has been struggling with painful periods, if you are struggling with unexplained infertility, if you have deep pain with intercourse, if you just have a lot of unexplained symptoms and you don't really know what's going on, or maybe you know you have endometriosis, this is a wonderful episode for you. She's a wealth of knowledge. I pick her brain selfishly as well, and she shares her protocol of how she supports her clients, and it's just wonderful. So just to give you some background, Cindy is a registered dietitian. She is also a Master of Applied Nutrition, MAN, M-A-N, and she specializes in endometriosis, and she knows what it's like to go right alongside this with you because she struggles with endo herself as an endo warrior. She's turned her own years of painful, confusing symptoms into a mission to help hundreds of women find real relief through the power of nutrition. So she's just a wealth of knowledge, and let's get started. All right, Cindy, I'm so excited to have you here on the show, and I'm excited for our listeners to learn more about you and all of the wisdom that you have about endometriosis. Before we get started, can you just tell me a little bit about yourself, about why you got into this work, why you're passionate about it?
Absolutely. And thank you so much for the invitation and for having me. So my name is Cindy Dabrowska, and I'm an endometriosis and fertility specialized dietitian. And much like many other healthcare providers, I have a very personal tie to endometriosis because I live with endometriosis, sadly, although there are positives. I'll share maybe a little bit more about my story in the moments to come. But so I have a personal tie to endometriosis, and I'm one of those people who, you know, much like many other women with endo, have kind of gone through the ringer in terms of like birth control and surgery and other hormonal interventions and being brushed off by one doctor and then the next and the next specialist. So I'm sure many, many women with endometriosis who'll be watching and listening can relate. So anyway, I've been through that whole, you know, typical experience of somebody with endometriosis. And actually before my surgery in 2018, I kind of got fed up with just the ineffective interventions that were being thrown my way. Long story short, I actually did find quite a bit of success with hormonal birth control, but after a few years of being on it for symptom management, it just kind of stopped working. I started getting all sorts of strange symptoms again, breakthrough bleeding, weight gain, mood changes, you know, my pain came back. And when I approached my doctor about these symptoms and what I should do next, she basically just said, let's put you on a stronger birth control pill. And something about that didn't sit right with me. And that sort of began my hunt for alternative management options. And that's when I really started to discover nutrition and functional medicine and, you know, strategic testing and herbals and things like this. And happy to report that even before my surgery in 2018, things really started to look up and improve for me. And pretty much since then, I've lived a relatively good quality of life as somebody with endometriosis. And then just before I started my private practice working in the space and serving women in the space, you know, I thought to myself, if I can do it and if so many other chronic inflammatory conditions can be managed this way, why couldn't we do it with endo? And that kind of started the Endofertility Dietitian Instagram page and my other socials platforms and ultimately my business. So that was much, much longer story than I intended to tell, but that's sort of an intro into who I am and what I do professionally.
I love that. So how long did it take you to actually be diagnosed with endo?
Oh, goodness.
So it can be a while for some women.
Yes. So I'm somebody who was symptomatic from my very first period ever at 12 years of age. And this is one of those like you know, strange things about endometriosis where you could be symptomatic after a fertility journey. You can only start to become symptomatic even in menopause in some cases. For some women, it's right off the gate during puberty, you know, with their first period. For some, it's after some kind of stressful event or something like that. So there's no like one marked start point when you become symptomatic, right? So for myself, 12 years of age, you know, first ever period was extremely debilitating and painful. And I was diagnosed in 2018. So, oh my gosh, let me do this math. So I was 12, hold what I have been in 2018. I think it's something like 15 years. Gosh. So it took me a really, really long time, sadly.
And so for you, your main symptom was painful periods. In the women that you work with, is that typically the main symptom that they're experiencing? Or do you find a lot of women have more atypical symptoms where it's not so obvious of like painful periods?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because what I will say is, you know, the 8 years that I've been working in this space and supporting women in this space, I have noticed this significant shift in how symptoms that we might have once thought of as rare are no longer as rare as we once thought. So, you know, maybe one in every 20, 25 women I'm connecting with are actually experiencing thoracic endometriosis symptoms, where they're having a collapsed lung, or they're coughing up blood, or they're having difficulty breathing, or having chest pain in these like high pain phases of the cycle. I will say though that that is not a typical well, I don't even know if I could say it's a tip, but it's not typically what we would associate with endometriosis. But yeah, I would say most women, painful periods, a lot of digestive symptoms, IBS-like symptoms, whether that's constipation, diarrhea, or sort of a mix of both, food sensitivities, really uncomfortable bloating. There's a lot of, I always make a point when I'm, you know, doing podcast recordings to mention the mental health side of living with a very isolating, lonely, chronic inflammatory condition. So there's a lot of like loneliness, there's a lot of depression, anxiety. Infertility is a huge one. So I would say that there's probably like two bigger buckets of, maybe three bigger buckets of sort of like symptoms that I see in practice. One is definitely like the painful periods. The other would be the infertility, whether symptomatic or asymptomatic. So your only symptom being infertility, but not really experiencing like the painful symptoms or the digestive symptoms. And then the third bucket would be the digestive symptoms. And that could be with or without some of the other more specific pain symptoms. So
yeah. So for someone who is struggling with infertility, let's say, but that's not super obvious, they don't have pain with intercourse or painful periods, are there any other things that would tip you off to think, oh, this might be endo? Are symptoms like migraines connected, or interstitial cystitis, or other like kind of inflammatory symptoms, something that would make you think that? Or is it sort of random, we just don't know until you do a laparoscopic surgery? You know, how would someone know if that's what they're going through? If someone, for example, is experiencing unexplained infertility, no one really knows what's going on, but they maybe suspect silent endo or something like that, is there anything in your world that's like, oh yeah, that's definitely something to think about if they don't have the classic presentation?
That's a really great question. I love this. So certainly, like, one thing, just very directly, if you are experiencing infertility, you haven't been able to conceive, or you're experiencing recurring losses, and you've had a comprehensive workup done, okay, not like a superficial, like, you know, a couple hormones here and there, maybe not even timed appropriately, you know, you haven't had a CMP, a complete blood count, maybe you haven't gone a little bit deeper, run things like homocysteine, maybe done like an MTHFR test, rate to gauge if you have an MTHFR gene mutation. Like, if you've done a comprehensive investigation and everything is really checking out and is optimal, just the fact that you haven't been able to conceive and or are experiencing recurring pregnancy loss can be an indication that you should be investigated for endometriosis or adenomyosis. But in addition to that, I would say if you're having... So there are there's like a handful of really subtle symptoms that I like to pay attention to. So cervical mucus patterns is one of those things. If you're experiencing like really long windows of either wet cervical mucus patterns, so I don't want to spend too much time unpacking this topic, but if you're like constantly feeling sort of like a wet sensation and it's spanning over two or more weeks, something like that, 10 plus days, or if you're getting an excessive amount of like a peak type cervical mucus, so slippery, stretchy, clear, if that's excessive, like if it's spanning well over 6 to 7 to 8 days, like you're seeing that for 10 plus days every cycle, that could actually be a good indication that, and I want to be very careful with my words here, because I don't want to say that this is diagnostic for endometriosis, but it can definitely be a sign that you should be investigated. So that's one thing. And the opposite can also be true. So if you're not producing any cervical mucus discharge, that could also be something to consider having a look at. Another thing would be abnormal bleeding patterns. So if you're bleeding a little bit with intercourse or after physical activity, or if you're experiencing excessive spotting prior to your period or tail end brown bleeding at the end of the period, that could be another kind of subtle sign that might prompt, you know, you at least beginning an investigation if this is something that could apply to you.
Okay.
There are some lab markers, and again, I want to be very clear, not diagnostic, but, you know, a CA125, CA125 tends to elevate with deep infiltrating endometriosis or large endometriomas, which typically you can see on an MRI or a detailed ultrasound. And if you have an endometrioma and you're, you know, diagnosing a physician is quite confident that it's an endometrioma, then you have endometriosis, because an endometrioma is a more advanced stage of the disease, right? So something like that, a CA125, an elevated CRP, trying to think if there's any other lab markers specifically that I look at, I would be paying very, very close attention to specific hormones. So like a 7-day post-ovulation estradiol, progesterone, prolactin. Again, not diagnostic, but these are pieces to the puzzle, right? I'm sure there's more that I'm missing, but...
And now a quick word from our sponsor. We've partnered with Needed to bring you this episode. Stress is something that many people can experience along the fertility journey, and it's something that influences how they handle oxidative damage. That's why supporting overall cellular health can be super valuable at any stage along the fertility journey. One product I personally love recommending is Needed's A Quality Support. I helped contribute to formulating this product, but even if I hadn't, I would still be confident recommending it because it's so great. It's designed to provide antioxidant and mitochondrial support with ingredients like L-carnitine, green tea extract, ALA, and PQQ. I also love pairing it with Needed's comprehensive prenatal and their CoQ10 for a comprehensive approach. Visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Okay, back to the show. And so are you typically seeing high estrogen patterns in women with endo? Like, can you break that down for our listeners of kind of what that relationship is with estrogen and endo and that whole picture?
Yeah, that's another really interesting question, because I've actually been seeing quite the opposite, a lot of the opposite lately. But it is pretty common, yes, to have high estrogen in the blood, or if you're doing like a functional urine test, like a Dutch test, for example. We do know that the endometriosis lesions themselves, they have heightened aromatase activity, right? So that's an enzyme that converts testosterone into more estrogen. And that's not always captured in blood work or functional test results. So even if your results are coming back and they're not necessarily showing high or abnormally high estrogen levels, it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have like high localized estrogen around your lesions. But this is like I said, it's this question's stumping me a little bit, because you know this is the population and I serve, and I've actually been seeing quite the opposite lately. But two things can be true. So yes, you can have high estrogen, and common symptoms of that would be things like heavy clotty bleeding, mood shifts before your period, a thick endometrial lining. It could be spotting before the period or tail end brown bleeding at the end of the period, excess histamine symptoms. So estrogen stimulates a type of an immune cell called mast cells to release histamine. And that can present in things like itchy skin, itchy eyes, runny nose, congestion, low grade fever, body aches, hives, rashes, things like this. So yes, high estrogen is common, because there's so many things I can say about here. That's why I'm hesitating. It's common because, you know, we know So first of all, we know that there is this sort of relationship between the gut microbiome and endometriosis. So we see a lot of dysbiosis within the gut microbiome, so an imbalance there. And the gut is the third step in how we clear estrogen through the body, right? That's how it exits the body. And so if there's an imbalance there, we can get cycling of estrogen back into the body, and then that can be reflected in like blood or like a functional urine test estrogen level. Mm-hmm. But also the liver is involved in estrogen clearance as well, right? And things like high dose pain relieving medications, under eating, thyroid dysfunction, nutrient deficiencies, all of these things that we know kind of plague women with endometriosis, at higher rates than somebody who maybe doesn't have endometriosis, will affect the liver. And then that can also lead to high estrogen levels. Mm-hmm. I have some theories as to why I'm seeing a lot of the opposite pattern with the low levels. I have some theories. I don't know if I'm correct with these theories, but you know, a lot of women with endometriosis are living with chronic pain and chronic inflammation, right? Which often leads to disrupted sleep. It leads to your nervous system being turned on, right? You're kind of in this constant chronic fight or flight state. Many of them are under eating. They're nutrient deficient. And when I'm trying to like decode a really complex case, like ultimately I try and go back to the simplest, like take me back all the way to the first step, you know, so I can understand what kind of steps follow leading to this, like in this example, low estrogen state. And so I think it could be any one of those things, right? Under eating, you know, under fueling, low cholesterol is huge, maybe poor brain ovary communication. But one thing I'll just like wrap up this thought with is that even if your estrogen levels are measuring low 7 days post ovulation or 8 days post ovulation or something like that, doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have a high estrogen state locally around the lesions, right? So, And then, you know, you can also be measuring just estradiol in the blood work, but you might actually be upregulating something like estriol, right? Which is another type of estrogen that we can measure on a functional urine test, like a Dutch. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. I mean, I would say as most things are in medicine and in health, it depends. Everything's different. There's multiple factors. It's not so cut and dry. Obviously, if it was, I don't think so many women would be missed. You know, this diagnosis wouldn't be missed. Women would be supported more if it was just a simple marker. This is what, you know, in my experience, conventional medicine doesn't do very well because it is so nuanced and it takes time and a lot of investigation and a lot of understanding multiple systems and multiple parts that, you know, our conventional system is so segmented into their different specialties. There's just not that cross communication. Like you mentioned, the gut microbiome is a huge player in estrogen circulation, which plays in liver, which then also affects your mental health. And those are all separate fields in medicine. And so they're not seen like integrated together. And I think that you really highlighted the complexity of endo. So for a person who suspects it, I know everything is always changing new. When I was in naturopathic medical school, you know, we learned that the only way to diagnose was a laparoscopic surgery. But I know there are things like you mentioned, the MRI, that can potentially give you a window without having to jump straight to surgery. Are there other things that you recommend for women with testing, whether it's functional and or in the conventional system, or is laparoscopic surgery still the one and only thing that people can kind of do?
That's a great question. So yeah, we're definitely seeing some advancements in diagnostic tools. So you can still, and I do want to kind of preface with the sort of disclaimer that you can still miss endometriosis by using these more advanced diagnostic tools now. So I think that most physicians, most people who work in the endometriosis space would probably still agree that a laparoscopy with excision would be the best way, the most comprehensive way to diagnose. But we are seeing advancements. Yes. So MRI, you can see deep infiltrating endo. You can see sort of like larger nodules or lesions, endometriosis lesions. There's also some endometriosis specialists who are using advanced ultrasound as well to diagnose endometriosis. And I'm not a specialist in this area. I don't perform ultrasounds or anything like that. So I don't want to say too much about this because I don't want to, you know, misrepresent something or miscommunicate something. But my understanding is that in individuals who are very, very well versed, they diagnose based off of the way that the tissue responds to liquid, fluid. There are certain appearances to it. There's, you know, a specific thickness to it. So it's quite advanced. It's actually very, very interesting. So that is also a diagnostic tool where we're seeing, you know, more advancement when it comes to diagnosing endo. And I want to be very clear and say that, like, looking at something like a CA-125 or a CA-19-9, for example, not yet included in, you know, practice guidelines and things like that. Like, you can't measure these things and say, oh, okay, right, if it's elevated, you have endometriosis. But we're seeing some very, very strong associations between if these levels are elevated and then, you know, a couple months or years down the line, or shortly after having tested, somebody goes in for a laparoscopy or an advanced ultrasound or MRI. In the majority of cases, there's confirmation of endometriosis. So, it's getting a little bit easier to diagnose endo.
Great. Yeah. And I know there's some new up and coming startups that are working on some other diagnostics.
Tests. Yeah.
Yeah. Some blood tests, some tests looking at stuff in menstrual blood. There's one company that I've heard about. And so I hope those just like get to market soon. It's like, come on, guys. Sure. But I know that whole world and the FDA approval and stuff is a whole process. But
it takes a while.
You know, I ask these questions because I think what I deal with in the fertility space and with women with hormones is a lot of like, well, I don't know. I don't know if I have this. Like, should I be doing this? When you support women with nutrition, lifestyle, all the things that you do, are you a person who's like, we need to make sure that we know for sure this is endo. We need to go do some, you know, maybe the surgery before we work on other stuff. Do you start right away on just the foundations and the dietary and lifestyle changes and then see if they improve, and if they don't, then send them off for more investigation? Like, how do you do that kind of support in your mind? Do you kind of wait to see if this is for sure endo and approach it differently, or it doesn't matter whether they have the diagnosis or not, you kind of approach it no matter what, just treating the person? Like, how is your approach with that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't require somebody to have an endometriosis, a formal endometriosis diagnosis, to work with me. And the way that I see it is, you know, we work on optimizing the gut. We work on, you know, understanding what your hormones are doing, how you're metabolizing your hormones, what's high, what's low, what's abnormal. You know, we look at nutrient gaps. We look at your diet and moving it towards an anti-inflammatory eating pattern. So I think whether or not you have a formal diagnosis, all of these things are all health promoting and all super helpful to, you know, prevent or reduce your risk of some kind of autoimmune or, you know, like some other chronic inflammatory or metabolic condition, right? So there's no downside, in other words, to pursuing these interventions. And then in the meantime, if they help with managing the symptoms that you're living with, or now or in future help with the way that endometriosis sort of behaves in your body after you get a formal diagnosis, amazing, right? There's no downside. We know that there's tons of literature around diet and specific aspects of diet helping with endometriosis symptoms and how endometriosis behaves in the body. We know there's a huge overlap between the gut and endometriosis. We're also now seeing, you know, the vaginal microbiome and the uterine microbiome, and that's how that's like a source of local inflammation that can also affect the way that endometriosis behaves in your body. So why not? But the last thing I'll say in response to this question is, endometriosis behaves differently in everybody, right? No two people have the same experience with endometriosis. And this is a hard reality that I had to learn as a, you know, a new practitioner, you know, close to a decade ago. I really wanted to be able to help every single person, right? I wanted, my approach is the best approach. I'm going to be able to change everybody's life. But the reality is with endometriosis, there are some people who are just living with extremely aggressive, deep infiltrating endometriosis where, you know, maybe they have excision surgery, they feel good for a couple months, and then sadly, you know, within 3, 4, 5 months, they're already seeing these large endometriomas come back, where they're already debilitated the way that they were 4 to 5 to 6 months prior when they had their surgery. And these cases certainly need to be approached with the understanding that sometimes these sort of holistic interventions are not going to be the solution. They can certainly be helpful, there's no doubt, and this is the hill that I'll die on, that they will always be helpful no matter how severe your symptoms are and how deep infiltrating your endometriosis is and all these things. But some people just need sort of a multi the word I'm looking for, like an approach that
function or multifactorial approach, maybe
multifactorial approach. Exactly. Thank you. So have the surgery, work on the gut. Maybe you need some hormone therapy, some kind of hormonal birth control or hormonal suppressant or something like that. And that's just a fact and a reality that I had to accept working in this space after many years. So, yeah.
I totally get that. I felt the same way when I was new in practice. I'm like, yeah, I can't help anyone. We just have to get to the root cause. And, you know, there's been times where I've had patients with endo where, you know, we do all the things, and then the best thing for them in that season of their life is to go back on birth control. And so, you know, I'm not a huge fan of birth control for many reasons, but I also see it as a tool, and sometimes it is useful. Like, I'm thinking of one patient in particular where we did all the things, but she was in grad school and her stress was like out of control, and she either had to drop out of grad school or get back on the pill because her pain was so debilitating and she couldn't drop out of grad school. Like, that wasn't an option for her, you know? And so there's no mercy in being like, no, like, you must just do fish oil and turmeric and all these things when it like wasn't working for her. And so she's actually starting to get off her birth control and get ready to get pregnant. And so we're having that conversation of, okay, how are you doing? Because that actually did help her a lot, the birth control, with all the other foundational things, you know, that we're doing. But for anyone listening, you know, I'm not pro birth control for all women's problems, but it is a tool, and there's no shame if that's what is needed for you in that season. So I think that's just like important to throw out, is we talk about this a lot on the podcast, that things are not black and white, and everything is gray when we talk about health, and that, you know, it's the intelligence of the use of tools in medicine that's important versus just the dogmatic ideology around certain things. And, you know, I get very frustrated in the conventional world when they don't approach anything from like a root cause, dietary, foundational root cause understanding, looking at all of the pieces. But I also don't agree with it only ever being like, no medicine, we can't ever use anything. So I think that that's important to just kind of have that grounded and intelligent, yeah, like you mentioned, multifactorial approach of looking at the person who's in front of you and treating what they need in that moment. Did you know proper hydration and mineral balance are key for hormone health, fertility, and preparing for pregnancy? This is why Dr. Morgan and I love Relight by Redmond's, the real salt people, a USA-made electrolyte powder with unrefined sea salt, over 60 trace minerals, plus bioavailable forms of potassium, calcium, and 2 forms of magnesium, malate and glycinate. These minerals support hormones, hydration, energy, and overall health. The best part is they taste delicious. I'm really picky about how things taste, and so you can rest assured this is Dr. Leah approved. I love lemon lime, but I know Dr. Morgan is a strawberry lemonade gal. Head to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15% off your order of electrolytes, real sea salt, natural toothpaste, and so much more. Again, head to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15%. Happy hydrating on your womanhood and fertility journey.
Yeah, I totally agree with you 100%. And the reality is, you know, we have literature that shows endo recurrence is reduced by several years with the use of hormonal suppressants or hormone therapies. That's not to say that can't be achieved without the use of these medications. I mean, I'm somebody who had surgery and I feel like my symptoms have been pretty stable, whether something's been brewing or growing. I mean, I did have an MRI recently, didn't show anything, but I don't know, right? But that's not to say that you can't achieve those same results without being on hormonal birth control or hormone therapies, but we have to also acknowledge that there is research in that space as well.
Yeah. So my next question is, I know that this can be tricky, and I feel similar to you. Like, early on in practice, I was just like, oh my God, we can do this. And then as I've practiced more, I've started to understand, what is your opinion based on what you've done on if someone has pretty, like, stage two or beyond endo, let's just say, is it possible to reverse with diet, lifestyle, foundational things, or is it better to have an excisional surgery and then kind of start fresh, or do the foundations, have the surgery, and then you prevent more growth? Like, can you reverse them, or do you really have to excise and then prevent growth? Does that make sense, that question?
I think so. Yeah. I'll take a stab at it, and then you can give me back.
Like, you, I guess as an overarching, in your opinion, do you think that dietary and lifestyle pieces alone can reverse or get rid of the lesions that are already there, or do you really need to also remove them in addition to all of the other factors?
Yeah. So I know that there are many fellow, dietitians, naturopaths, nutritional therapists in this space who do create content and claim that these lesions can reduce in size. My personal and professional opinion is that I think that you can manage the disease. I think that you can improve your quality of life. I think you can stabilize your quality of life. But I don't know that I would go so far as to say that you can take those physical lesions and you can shrink them. Yeah. I mean, when you look at literature, when you look at like cell line studies or animal studies, you do see things like curcumin and EGCG in green tea acting on those lesions and actually being able to shrink them. But we can't confidently say that that's what's happening when we're routinely consuming these foods or high doses of these supplements in a human body, right? So that is my personal and professional opinion. I don't think so. So there is a role for excision surgery for sure. But from the other side, from the perspective of excision surgery, there are risks associated with that too, right? Depending on the surgeon, depending on their experience, are they introducing, scar tissue? Are they doing any kind of adhesion prevention? I, working in this space, have seen every scenario. I've had people come to me with symptoms that they didn't previously have prior to excision surgery, and now they have these symptoms. Like, I was just speaking with a client yesterday who said she never had bladder symptoms or bladder pressure or pain prior to excision surgery. She had her excision surgery, and now she has bladder pressure pain, right? There are people who have gone and had excision surgery and they don't notice any change in their pain or their bleeding patterns or in any symptoms. I'm an example of that. Excision surgery didn't really relieve any symptoms for myself. I'm one of the lucky ones though, because I've been able to manage in other ways. But and then of course you have the group of women who have excision surgery and it's absolutely life-changing, right? And for some of them, it's like from the moment they have it, they're symptom-free for a decade or beyond, right? And then for others, it's they might get a couple months or a couple years of symptom relief, and then the symptoms start to creep back again. So did I answer your question?
Yeah, no, I love that approach. I feel similarly to you, and what I get the same question a lot about fibroids and things like that, of like, can we just shrink them with natural medicine? And I mean, there are some people that claim that they can. I personally haven't had as much success with that. You know, if you have a huge fibroid in your uterus and, or outside or inside of your uterus, for me, because I work in fertility, it's like, well, how much time do we have? You know, first and foremost, it's like, this could take a really long time and you want to be pregnant yesterday. And so, you know, there is a role sometimes with surgery and it has risks, like you said. And so it's a hard decision. I think I actually might have endo, funny because I always had debilitating periods my whole life growing up. Obviously before I knew what endo was, and I just thought that that was normal. However, they did get better when I started changing my diet and my lifestyle and stuff. But then we went down, we had to do IVF because of my husband's sperm. We tried to conceive for over 6 years, and he had a whole thing. It's a whole conversation for another day of why we ended up having to go down IVF. Obviously, I conceived, through IVF. So who knows if I was with a different partner who had normal sperm, if I would have struggled or not. So I don't know. I've never had like a laparoscopic investigation. I definitely have the high that higher estrogen pattern and, you know, histamine issues, detox problems, those kind of things. But I know that people have said pregnancy can help endo, and I'd love to know your opinion on that, but that it can come back after you're done having your kids. And so it's something I've been curious about because I've also dealt a lot with painful sex, and for reasons, like lots of different reasons, not just for like an endo type deep pain. But since I've been postpartum, I'm like, oh my gosh, because I had all these other pain pictures that were kind of overshadowing, I don't think I ever noticed that deep pain with sex was maybe a part of my story, or maybe it's worse now. And then I'm just like, because my sister has endo really bad. She's getting ready to do the excision surgery. And I'm just like, huh, like maybe I do, because all the parts and pieces I never thought I had, because I had painful periods, yes, but they weren't like so debilitating that I couldn't function. But now I'm wondering with like this deeper pain with sex and stuff. So it's kind of on my radar where it's like, wow, I think I like lived my whole life thinking one thing, and maybe I have been struggling with this. And and that's kind of, it's selfish for me, not only for my patients, but myself, to learn more about this and try to understand it, because I'm trying to understand, like, I don't have anything crazy where I am, my quality of life is greatly disrupted, but I'm also still breastfeeding. But is that something that I should investigate? And I'm also saying for a person listening, you know, who's maybe in a similar boat where maybe there's a few things, maybe they have some pain with sex, you know, positional pain, or maybe some painful periods, but it's not crazy. Like, could this be something that's going on? And can I just make lifestyle changes? Is that enough? You know, like, these are the kind of questions I think women think about in this space, because it is such a confusing condition. And so my question through all of that is, have you seen pregnancy playing a role in helping endo, or does it just dampen it for a while, similarly to like being on birth control, like a natural hormonal suppression type of situation, even though there are more hormones in pregnancy, so maybe it would make it worse. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. By the way, this is going to sound super creepy, but I think my first ever introduction to you, I was listening to, I think it was on Dr. Kalia Waddle's podcast, and I was like, oh, we have so much in common, because like our fertility journey, it's we have a pretty severe male factor issue as well.
Interesting.
Bless you guys, you've been able to grow your family, that's so beautiful. I was like, and then I think that prompted me actually reaching out to you. I think I sent you a DM after I listened to that podcast. That's so funny. It's such a small world. But anyway, back to your question.
I love that.
Yeah, so We it's a higher progesterone sort of stage of life too in pregnancy, right? And when you think about all the things that happen at the level of the endometriosis, lesions, the upregulated aromatase that we spoke about earlier, we see growth factors, production of growth factors are heightened around the endometriosis lesions. We see those inflammatory chemicals, right? They're produced in higher quantities at the level of the endometriosis lesions, and progesterone helps with all of those things, right? It blocks all of those things. So when we're in this sort of season of life, like pregnancy, where there's a higher progesterone state, it helps with all of those things. So it kind of makes sense that women would find relief. You're also now going, you know, 9+ months, like assuming your cycle is not returning immediately postpartum without bleeding, right? And not always, but for many women, the periods, bleeding, menstruating, this is a very high pain phase of the cycle with endometriosis, right? And so when you're going this like extended window of time where you're not bleeding, you're not getting that uptick in inflammatory prostaglandins that are needed for the shedding of the uterine lining, absolutely, it's logical that you're going to see sort of improvements in overall pain. I had a client once who, you know, had been trying to conceive for many, many years. She went through IVF. The IVF almost kind of like triggered thoracic endo symptoms. And then she miraculously became pregnant through our work together. And then as soon as she became pregnant, like all of those symptoms went away, even the thoracic endometriosis symptoms went away. And I attribute that, I think, I could be wrong, but I think it's that higher progesterone.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
100%. Also, did they come back for her like after pregnancy, or did it? Because that's my question. I'm like, there's stem cells, there's all sorts of stuff in pregnancy. I'm like, does it heal? Or is it just, the progesterone state that brings it down? I'm curious.
Yeah.
Let's take a moment to hear a word from one of our sponsors. If you are wanting to balance your hormones and support your liver, your digestion, your sleep, your overall health, whether you're preparing for pregnancy or not, you have to check out Earthly Wellness. I love herbal tinctures. When you mix different herbs together, you get a synergistic effect that's even more powerful than if you were to take the herbs alone. And you don't have to take a handful of capsules. Yet finding good blends that are effective and that actually taste good is really hard. So I was thrilled when we discovered Earthly. For hormones and detox support, I would recommend their Liver Love, their Lymphatic Drainage, and their Detox Defense tinctures. To support stress in the immune system, consider their Adaptogenic and Immune Support tincture and their Sleepy Time tincture if you are looking for support with sleep. And they also have a blend called Nourish Her Naturally, which has some of my favorite herbs such as dandelion, red raspberry leaf, spearmint, and nettles, and it tastes delicious. They even have a magnesium cream that you can rub on your feet at night to support sleep, stress, and your hormones. Their site is incredible. They have so much to offer, and their tinctures are absolutely delicious. Many of them are in a glycerite. My kids absolutely love them. They hold their mouth open like little birdies waiting for their Earthly tinctures. It's so cute. Head to earthly.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 10% on all their different products. You will be amazed at what they have. Earthly.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 10%. Okay, now back to the show.
You know, I would say the group of women that I've connected with who, you know, have a formal endometriosis diagnosis, go on to become pregnant, you know, birth their baby, and then cycles come back and, you know, the whole thing continues. I would say that the bucket of women for which those symptoms kind of reduce and stay reduced in the long term is very small. So the large majority of them do see those symptoms come back. And yes, you're in this sort of protective high progesterone state, but then at the same time, postpartum, you're sleep deprived. You're maybe not eating as well. You're not in the same sort of habits and routines as you might have been prior to the birth of your baby. So they're all things that are probably, you know, affecting your body. And when those factors compound on top of each other over a prolonged window of time, those things are probably not helping the way that the endo behaves in the body too much, right? So that's one of the most frustrating recommendations when doctors are like, yeah, just go and get pregnant. It's like, I know. Short-term pain relief for what? Like, but you definitely hear stories of women becoming pregnant, having their babies, and then having like a lower level of baseline pain for many, many years after that. I would say the large majority do see sort of a resurgence of the pain and symptoms coming back within a few months or a few years.
I know when I had my daughter and my cycle came back postpartum with her, I like went my first period or whatever, I went to the bathroom and I was just like, oh my God, there's just blood there. I was like, what? You know, like, because it always would be accompanied with pain. And that has continued literally every cycle that I've had between her and my son since my son. And I was like, what is this, like this miracle thing? Because it was always pain and it hasn't been. But again, I'm still breastfeeding him. So who knows? And maybe it will come back. But now I'm feeling potentially with like pain with sex, which is another thing. Some women I know, that's their only symptom, you know, is pain with like deep penetration, and they don't necessarily have painful periods. So it's still, it's something that I will be investigating eventually once I'm not breastfeeding and in a different state, but thank you. I know a lot of what you mentioned, so I want to get into some of the treatments and support, but you had mentioned curcumin, which is found in turmeric, and ECGC, I always mess that up, EGCG, which is found in green tea. And it's interesting because those are actually very helpful for cancer. And I know a lot of people have talked about endo being similar to cancer more than just like a hormonal imbalance condition. And I think that's why it's been misunderstood, because the mechanism of how it works was not being fully understood until they had that approach. I know I'm friends with one of the CEOs of one of the startups that is working on trying to identify endo in menstrual blood. And the way that they found that marker was because they were working with a oncology scientist who understood cancer pieces better, and they've like found this connection with some piece there. But can you speak to that at all? Like in the support that you give to women in the endo space, do you find that similar treatments that are recommended for cancer are similar to help endo? Is your approach more, you know, hormonal balance, microbiome inflammation, or are there parts and pieces like with the antioxidant world and all of that that we kind of see in cancer? Because it is growth that is inappropriate, right? And so endo is so fascinating to me. I'm like, what is it? What's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, fascinating is definitely one way to describe it for sure. It's so complicated, right? Like what you alluded to, there's the growth factors that I think share similarities with things like cancer. We know that some cancer treatments target estrogen because estrogen is very growth promoting. And one thing that you might expect to see very often in an endometriosis patient population, I want to say maybe I see like a quarter of the time, but sort of an upregulated growth promoting metabolite of estrogen, that 16-hydroxy. Mm. I don't see that too much, but there's probably a bit of an overlap there with cancer. I'm probably not the best person to ask about like medication type.
Yeah, oh no, I'm not talking about medications. I'm talking about like diet things, you know.
Yeah.
Which at the end of the day, I'm sure so much that we do dietary wise is similar across the board. It's like most dietary things are helpful for all chronic, you know, inflammatory conditions, you know, for the most part. But I just wondered if you had anything to say about that. And I would love to learn about what you do recommend, you know, when someone comes to see you, like what kind of approach are you taking from a diet supplement and or lifestyle perspective? You know, what kind of things are you doing?
Yeah, so this is like a broad sweeping disclaimer across the board that there's so much nuance, right, with diet, lifestyle, with endo. But I would kind of summarize my approach in sort of like four steps. And this is based on the way that we know that endo behaves in the body. So one is looking at the gut microbiome. I kind of already alluded to estrogen being eliminated through the gut, other hormones exiting the body through the gut. We know that the gut can be a major site of inflammation, a major site of histamine production. We know that there are lots of pro-inflammatory bacteria that can live there. And we have research that tells us, you know, we're more likely to have an imbalanced microbiome as, you know, women with endometriosis. So, and things like constipation, things like diarrhea, these are definitely going to intensify or worsen symptoms, right? Because constipation tends to form sort of a pro-inflammatory environment that will then compound on top of inflammation stemming from endo. You can get some estrogen cycling back into the body that way. And then on the opposite end, like if you're having a lot of looser stools, diarrhea type stools, you're going to be losing a lot of nutrition that way, right? Nutrition that your body could be using to fight that inflammation. So whether or not these things, and I would argue they are directly tied to the way that endo behaves in your body, but whether or not, like in one unique individual person's case, this is like the, you know, a huge thing that transforms their symptoms, I still think that there's so much value to starting there and not just like optimizing the gut microbiome, but also optimizing your ability to digest your food and absorb nutrition, right? Because endo is this chronic inflammatory condition, we see the body pulling resources away from things like stomach acid production or motility or digestive enzyme production. Because, you know, to use an analogy, like, it's like a currency, right? If you only have so much money, but you need to buy five different things, if you only have enough money to buy two things, then you can't get those three other things, right? So it's the same sort of idea. Like if your body only has so many resources to distribute throughout these, among these functions, then something is going to become compromised. So it's also optimizing digestive function. And so that's kind of one of the big things. And then the second piece is the hormones. Again, another site of major source of inflammation for people with endometriosis. And a lot of people, when they think about hormones with endo, they think about estrogen, like we've spoken about, right? And certainly endo is estrogen dependent, but I would argue that every hormone matters with endometriosis. We've already kind of touched on why progesterone is so important and so powerful. I always kind of crack jokes, like if I could make a meme of myself, it would be me as like Oprah being like, progesterone for you, progesterone for you, progesterone for you. Of course, you know, there are unique cases where some women don't respond the way they should to bioidentical progesterone or strategies that, you know, are meant to help with progesterone production naturally. But I think progesterone's incredible. We know that there's this sort of progesterone resistance component where even if you might be making an adequate amount of progesterone as somebody with endo, your progesterone might not be binding to receptors. Mm-hmm. So progesterone's very, very important. That's a big focus area the large majority of the time because, and I don't know if you're seeing this in your practice, but I feel like there's this like epidemic of just like low progesterone in women across the board.
Low sperm and low progesterone. What is going on?
I agree.
Theories.
Yes. I'm sure we're probably aligned on some of those theories, but
Yes,
that's the
totally.
progesterone. You know, prolactin is another hormone that we see high in a lot of women with endo. It acts as a pro-inflammatory chemical in women with endo, and it can suppress FSH and LH, which would then affect ovulation. And for anybody who's listening who doesn't know, we only produce progesterone on the other side of ovulation. So we really want to optimize that whole cycle phase, right? We want to ovulate, assuming you're not suppressing ovulation with hormone therapies or birth control. And things like testosterone and DHEA sulfate, they're very much involved in inflammation as well as pain sensitivity, right? So if you have low levels, you're going to be a little bit more sensitive to pain. If you have high levels, it's going to drive a lot of inflammation and potentially contribute to that overall inflammatory load. And then we also see that sluggish thyroid function is associated with more severe forms of endo, more aggressive endo progression, symptom presentation. And so all of these hormones matter, right? So that's like another kind of area that I focus. Third is general sort of inflammation. So kind of what we alluded to already previously, we don't always have a ton of control over inflammation stemming from endometriosis. Sometimes we do, right? In some people, they're lucky, they respond very, very positively to these changes, and others don't. So what I do is I look for compounding sources of inflammation. Do we have an insulin resistance issue? Are the liver enzymes elevated? Is there a big burden on the liver? Are there nutrient gaps that we can easily satisfy? Is there a histamine issue here? So I'm kind of searching out, like, where else could this inflammation be coming from? And then I'm creating goals and supporting patients with, you know, guiding them on interventions to help with those compounding sources of inflammation so that we can, the analogy I like to use is like, think of a stack of books. The bigger that stack of books, the heavier it's going to be. And so we're looking to take some of those books off the stack, right, and make the load a little bit lighter. And then the fourth piece is the nervous system piece, right? I'm seeing more and more of this sort of abnormal internal sensitivity, central sensitization, right, where you've got this abnormal sensitivity to pain of the internal organ. So even gentle stimuli, like maybe a tighter pair of sweatpants or something like that, or leaning up against a counter, triggers this, like, you know, just very exaggerated sort of pain or swelling or inflammation or bloat response. So we're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing a lot of nervous system involvement. One way for anybody who's listening to gauge whether you might have some nervous system involvement in your symptom picture is if you've had surgery, the lesions have been excised, but your pain persists, right? Because there are certain types of nervous system driven pain that even when you remove the physical stimuli, right, the physical cause of the pain, when that pain signal has been firing for long enough, your nervous system learns that pain signal, and whether or not the physical stimuli is present, the pain persists. Mm-hmm. So, and then we work on the nervous system piece. And sometimes the nervous system piece looks like just equipping the nervous system with essential vitamins and minerals to be able to function optimally. Sometimes it's using adaptogenic herbs. Sometimes it's really just kind of getting really honest about what our lifestyle looks like. And are we staying up really late at night? Are we on the screens before bed? Are we working a really stressful job? Are we surrounded by really stressful, annoying people? Like anything that's really going to take a little bit of that load off the nervous system, right? So that's sort of a little brief overview of my approach. And then, of course, there's things that you can investigate even deeper, like the genetic side of things, right? Some people are just genetically predisposed to higher levels of inflammation, right? Because that's just their genetic makeup. Or, they're genetically predisposed to issues with absorption of certain vitamins or certain minerals and things like this, right? So there's other kind of more advanced topics that I might look at, but that's sort of a general overview of my approach.
That's great. I love that. Yeah, I feel like we have a similar approach, but I love that you broke it down. And then do you do a lot with mental emotional stuff too? Like, do you find that people with endo have past traumas or stresses or anything like that that you weave into the work? Or is that kind of something you haven't gone in deep into much?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely acknowledge that that's very real, right? We know that there is a lot of this past trauma being associated with endometriosis and the way that it behaves and presents in the body. But I'm not going to pretend that I'm a mental health professional.
Yeah,
so
like,
I do my best.
I mean, like, I'll like refer people out as well.
Yeah, 100%. Like, yeah. So
I'll be doing this work.
Yes, I would love to be Superwoman and be able to do everything. I still think that I can sometimes, but 100%, yeah, referring out, encouraging them to talk to somebody, or, you know, even referring to these incredible programs that we have available now online, you know, where you could do some nervous system work at your own sort of speed and time. But yeah. Oh, yeah. Amazing. Very important.
Oh, this is amazing. I am very excited. Maybe I'll add you as a recommended practitioner inside of my membership for people who are struggling with endo. Can you tell us, like, how people can work with you, where you're at, if people are listening and they're like, oh, I really love her approach, I really want to see her. Can you just kind of tell us all the things?
Yeah, for sure. So my most active platform is probably Instagram. So my handle there is endo.fertility.dietitian. I also post weekly YouTube videos, and my channel there on YouTube is Endo Fertility Space Channel. I am not as active on TikTok, but my handle is the same, endo.fertility.dietitian. And my website's endometriosisdietitian.ca. So if you're keen on exploring working together, the best first next step would be to book in for a discovery call. I also just launched a free masterclass all about my approach and kind of some of the things that we talked about in this podcast today. So if anybody's interested, if you know, you wouldn't mind putting it in the link, I can share the link with you. And that would be a great place to start as well.
Oh, that's amazing. You are awesome. Thank you for doing this work. It's hard to find good endo practitioners. And I think, you know, not everybody has to have the condition that they support, but I have found personally that the people who do work around a condition that they have themselves or have been through tend to be really wonderful practitioners, because they go so deep because they're trying to solve it for themselves, and they have so much empathy and understanding and care, because they know what it's like to be in that person's shoes. And so I am just thrilled that I found you and that we were able to connect here. And if anyone is looking for some good endo support, I'm excited to be able to direct them your way.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
Do you mind if I take a...
If your heart aches for a baby, whether you're dreaming of motherhood someday or you're already on the path and it hasn't been going as you imagined, I want you to know that you do not have to do this alone. Consider joining me inside of my Womanhood Wellness membership. You get a custom blueprint unique to your woman essence type, which is where you are right now on the journey. You have access to all of my courses and content, which includes how to boost egg and sperm quality, the energetics of fertility, investigating fertility, optimizing IVF if that's a path you have to go down, navigating pregnancy loss. I have my Essential Foundations course, where you learn all the things that you really need to know to have a thriving hormonal infertility system. You learn the hormone handbook, where I dive deep into all the different hormonal imbalances and what you can do naturally to rebalance them. I have deep dive courses on vaginal microbiome, in detoxing, on mindset. I give you my natural medicine protocols. You have the ability to order labs on your own. You get discounts on supplements and other products. I have organized the community by your season. So if you are breaking up with birth control, you can jump in a chat with women in that exact same season. If you are trying to conceive, or if you are going through pregnancy loss or infertility or IVF or low libido, there is a group of women who are going through the same thing. We also have full community areas like our breakfast club, where every Monday we share what we're having for breakfast to inspire each other, and our daily flow, where we connect as a collective community and do challenges and learn from each other in that way. On top of all of that, I do a monthly live Q&A where you can bring your questions, and they're always recorded so you can listen if you can't make them live. And then I have various calls with other practitioners like Sadie, our amazing personal development coach, and so many others, where you will be able to receive healing and learn other perspectives. Being a member inside Womanhood Wellness also gives you discounts to join my upcoming immersions. Take around 22 women for a month to dive deep into a specific topic, like decoding desire, or building your dream life, or navigating painful periods, or navigating unexplained infertility. This is the place that you want to be if you want to know all of the natural root cause and supportive measures that you can take to optimize your womanhood journey and your path to and through motherhood. Head to womanhoodwellness.com and use code podcast to save 20% off your first month. I can't wait to see you inside. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and share with a friend who would benefit from this content. Please remember that the views and ideas from this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to be a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis and treatment of any disease. Consult with your provider before integrating any of this information into your own healthcare plan. A healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.